Come hang out with Mia and my friend Coralie as we talk about her career in games and her work with big IP like Pokemon and Marvel. Stick around to the end and I'll tell you about two podcasts I was on recently. Let's jump in.
You're listening to Make the Game with Matt Hackett.
Well, Coralie, thanks for joining me today. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm just coming off work on a Friday. So
Best time of the week.
I'm ready for the weekend.
That's amazing. I am really anxious to talk to you about all the cool things that you do, you know, your day-to-day job, your association with the Puerto Rico Game Developers Association. I thought it might be a fun place to start asking you about this. It seems like just yesterday, but it might have been a month or two now. I opened up the Google Play Store. I opened it up and there's your shining, smiling face at the top of the banner broadcasted to millions of people. So cool. How did that come to be?
So I want to say towards summer of last year, some of the folks from the ERG and diversity and inclusion, like department, at Google reached out to me because they really wanted to feature a bunch of different Latin American like games. And I rallied the troops like I always do, like, hey, I need to know what you're working on. Do you have a demo? Is it on, you know, the Google Play Store and stuff? And like just a bunch of folks started sending me with the Latinx and gaming organization as well. They happened to have a list that they had curated too. And really I just like sent it over. And again, like not expecting anything, not really, because I have a lot of people that do ask me for resources like that, and that's part of what we do. And I want to say like around August or September, they're like, hey, so we want to highlight you. And I'm like, wait, what? Can you answer these questions? I'm like, sure, yeah. And you know, it was for Hispanic Heritage Month, and I didn't really know like the scope of what they were doing. I thought it was just going to be like a one-off like article or something. And then when I see like it comes out, I'm like so excited. And then, oh my God, Gamelo's on here. And like the boxer and like these other like really, really like big people and stuff. And I'm just like, what is this? but I was like so excited. I showed my family and they were like, at first they didn't really understand the scope either, because they don't, you know, and until I showed them like, no, open your Google app and look for this.
Yeah.
And like, wait a minute, this is like everywhere. I'm like, yeah, it's everywhere. And the company didn't know to like, I'm at Niantic right now, and I give them the heads up whenever like I'm interviewed and that kind of stuff. You know, as long as like I'm not like representing the company, they never have issues with it. But it's more just like, hey, heads up, like so and so is interviewing me, or this company is like highlighting me or whatever. And I just gave them that like general heads up. And then starting, you know, Hispanic Heritage Month, I'm like, hey, so this happened. And everyone was like super excited about it, and you know, coming from Puerto Rico, where there's not many of us in this industry, mm-hmm. and we come from what a lot of folks consider like such a small island, seeing me and my flag there and like being able to tell my story, how I got into this, like it was special. Like it was the first time I felt like, oh my God, people see me.
That's so cool. What is the game dev scene like in Puerto Rico?
So it's been around, I want to say, for about 10-15 years. We do have, I think we have like 7 to 9 studios that have been established.
Oh wow.
But they tend to be smaller studios. You know, like very indie games that they're working on, or they're generally more like working on like as outsourced talent for other mm-hmm. companies. We do have like a bunch of really great games that are, again, on the App Store or for console. There's also like a pretty good D&D scene over there.
Nice.
It seems to be like pretty popular. But as a whole, like, the fact is we only have one university that does a degree in video game development. They're more focused on like art and game design, as generally speaking, not so much the programming or any of the other disciplines. And there are some other universities that offer, you know, degrees in engineering or IT or networking. And they do really well. Like, a lot of folks that graduate from there end up in NASA, MIT, et cetera, but they never really consider games a viable career, or mm-hmm. don't even think that it's possible to like apply what they're learning here to games. And we do have universities that you can graduate with like art degrees and that kind of stuff. But again, like, they don't consider games like a viable career. So it's, you know, with the organization that I'm a part of, it's a lot of education that we're doing and a lot of showing like, hey, this is really like career-wise, this is viable.
Right.
Like, you can generate revenue out of this. An industry can be established out of this. We just need the people that, like, how do you say it? Like, will believe in us. We'll believe that it's possible. And Puerto Rico has a lot of investors. There's a lot of, the tech scene is pretty good over there as well. Like, there's a lot of experimentation. But again, like, games is just not the thing that they think of. They think of blockchain, they think of crypto, yep. all of this, but it's like, no, like, there are applications
yeah.
outside of that.
Very cool.
But yeah, like, we have a community. Very, very talented artists, programmers, game designers, a lot of 3D modelers and animators. But what they're running into is like, they can't stay on the island if that's what they want to do.
Mm.
So we do have a lot of folks leaving to the mainland that. Or other countries.
Yeah. I remember when I was a kid, I similarly didn't know that games was a viable option, right? Like, I grew up in Midwest America where it was like viable careers were more like teacher, coal miner. There was a university you could go be a professor or something. It was more those kinds of jobs. Very little yeah. software. And I had a friend show me QBasic, and like, he would show me the game, then show me the code, and like, you can make games. Like, whoa, like, blew my mind, right? Like, sometimes people just need to know that it's an option. Like, mm-hmm. you know, when I was growing up, you'd see a Nintendo cartridge. I didn't know you can make that. Like, I couldn't make that. I had no path in my mind led from A to B, like me making that game, you know? So is that what you're involved with the Puerto Rico Game Developers Association? You like work with these studios and onboard people as...
Yep.
Is that what you're doing with them?
So really our function is to, what we're trying to do is bring the resources to the island and show the mainland and other countries that, hey, there's a really good workforce here that you can definitely reach out to and bring on to your companies. But we do education, we do workshops, we reach out to different universities to really get them updated on what the current industry is like. And, you know, we have a board of, I think we're 7 or 9 now.
Wow.
I'm the vice chair.
Very cool.
Executive vice chair.
Sounds so official.
Yeah, I know, right? I'm one of the folks that's like in the main, based here in the US. Everyone else is kind of on the island. We just had one move to Florida, and another one sometimes is between Puerto Rico and Canada. So at least we have that like actual perspective of someone who's in the industry actually being able to say, hey, just in case there are these updates that are coming, you know, or there's this change that's coming for our industry. This is what they're looking for now. This is what types of jobs are really, really sought after. If we can teach the students that are now learning, you know, how to develop games, specific skill sets to what it is that they're looking for over in these companies, this is what you need to learn. This is what you need to teach them.
Very cool.
I think off the top of my head, one of like the biggest that I always bring up is like, hey, tech art is a thing. And everyone was like, what is that? Because I've never heard of that before. I'm like, yeah, so tech art is this. And it's really sought after. And you are unicorns within our, you know, our industry. Everyone wants you. So if you don't know whether to decide between, you know, like programming or art, because you like both, which happens a lot in our universities, or you like VFX, but you also kind of like, you know, digging into Unreal or Unity and just kind of playing around with stuff, guess what? You don't have to choose. You can do both.
And I think there's so many times where someone needs that kind of guidance. Like, you're so right. Like, tech art is not universally known. Like, your average gamer probably doesn't even really know, like, they understand FX and stuff, but they don't understand how shaders work, and the complicated math would go right over their head, right? So that's great to be able to connect to people who are interested in that stuff with like the path they didn't know was available.
Yeah,
I love that.
And then other things we do game jams. Last year, we were able to bring some scholars to GDC, thanks to the Latin American Games Foundation. I think am I saying that right? Federation, the Latin American Games Federation, which is, you know, a bunch of different countries across Latin America. They came together specifically like from the game development side of things, and just we help each other out. We unify, we knowledge share, we resource share, etc.
That's great.
So last year we were able to bring in some folks to GDC. First time ever we've been able to do something like that. We help with career fairs. And again, it all, especially with Puerto Rico. We do a yearly showcase as well. Puerto Rican talent. I can link you that one later.
Yeah.
So if you really want to see like what's actually existing and what's in development and with talent from the island, we work together with Yo Soy Un Gamer, and Frankie Lopez, and we just like highlight what people are doing. And it's kind of like this moment where everyone's like so excited and they want to see like the culmination of their work being shown to the entire island, because we broadcast this on one of the local channels.
Oh, how cool.
As well as like the internet, we live stream it and everything. And
like a local TV network or like a radio network or.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Local TV network. It's the same. So Yo Soy Un Gamer has a segment on one of the local channels. I think I don't even remember which one it is right now. If it's not every day, it's every week. And once a year when we do the showcase, he takes that segment and just broadcasts it for the showcase. So
that's cool.
Everyone gets to see, you know, like what it is that we're working on. It's pretty popular as well with like, you know, folks that play games too, because a lot of people that play video games don't realize that we actually have a community on the island. And it's that moment where it's like, oh my God, I want to learn more about this game. I want to play it. Where can I download it? A lot of hype around it.
Yeah. Oh, that's so cool. So I know that you had worked previously with my wife, Andrea, working on UX at Scopely. How would you describe what you're doing these days?
So I am now at Niantic. Like I mentioned before, I've been here. My 3-year anniversary was this week. Oh,
congrats. Very cool.
So I'm a UX designer. Right now I am working on Wayfair, which is our geolocation based tool to let folks actually submit and nominate new way spots. So if you play something like Pokemon Go or Ingress and you see a real world location that you would like maybe turned into a Pokestop or a gym, you can nominate that location through this tool. It gets reviewed by the community and a decision is taken on whether to add it to the map or not. So right now we're working on an app version of this because currently it's browser-based. So I'm working with another UX designer on that. I'm working on something else that I can't really talk about right now, but it's also like very data-driven, very internal kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but before Wayfair, I was working on Marvel World of Heroes.
Oh, cool.
So that just got announced this past summer. And I was on that team for, I want to say, like 2.5 years.
Wow.
And leading UX design on that.
Cool.
And it's been a lot of fun, a lot of learnings, like a lot of, like, I've only ever worked on one AR app.
Mm-hmm.
And through these two, like, experiences, like really understanding everything that it takes to not only design around AR, but also taking into account like a lot of tech limitations, a lot of scanning that needs to happen in order if you want objects to like really, really feel immersive, like digital objects to really feel immersive with the space around you.
Mm-hmm.
Like the tech needs to be able to scan the space around you and do that effectively, do that. How do you say it?
Like constant scanning.
Mm. Yeah. Like, and authentically as well, like as accurate as possible. There we go.
I see.
Otherwise it looks weird or janky or yeah. The experience that you're trying to build doesn't really work the way that you had hoped. So a lot of learning around that. And
so a player will have a phone, right? And the scanning you're talking about, is that just happening through their camera and it's analyzing the images that it sees to try to figure out the 3D representation of it? Is that what's going on?
Yeah. Either that or you have things that have already been. So we talk a lot about like VPS. There's already like a few examples of, you know, publicly available out there of what they're doing. And VPS, what it does is it's not only about the object, but also the location geographically of that object around you. And it stores all of that information so that when you're building an experience, it knows where you are in relation to the object that's in front of you that you're trying to interact with. So let's say you, and just in case, this is like total hypothetical. Like I'm just giving a general example, nothing specific.
Right.
What I mean is I'm not aware of anything being worked on that's like this right now. This is just me coming.
You are committing to nothing.
Exactly.
Love it.
So let's say there is, I don't know, a big statue of a Gundam. Like Ooh. In a square, I don't know.
Yeah.
And it's already been scanned and that scan and that mesh is accessible in like our database. A developer has created an experience around it. So when I start interacting with that object, it knows where I am in relation to that object and it knows the object and everything, like the volume, let's call it that, the volume of that object. It created almost, we call it a mesh. It's kind of like a 3D model.
Mm-hmm.
So the experience knows where I am and where the object is. And let's say in order to start the experience, the first thing that happens is other Gundams like fly out from behind the Gundam that's in front of me. So depending on what I'm facing and where I'm facing, I can see those Gundams come from behind it, you know, and it'll come in front of it. It'll be like obfuscated by the object itself. Mm-hmm. If it requires me to walk to a specific position in relation to that object, I do that and then the experience can continue, or I can see like a different part of the experience. It's all already available. Really what starts it is, are you at the location? Is it in front of you? And from there, it goes, it does its thing.
Very interesting.
So
have you, I've noticed when describing UX to people who, especially non-technical people, like my mom, for example, right? Like she'll struggle with when I describe what it is that, that someone such as yourself does, like, I don't have good words for it. Like, do you have like a way that you talk about, because like UX design, like the experience encompasses so much, right? And design is such sometimes a vague word that kind of means everything and nothing. Like, do you have a way to describe it so that we have a better idea of like what exactly it is that you're doing in that space, or like a day-to-day, or like what all it encompasses?
I have multiple ways.
Ooh, love it.
Technically, you know, it is as a UX designer, my job is to advocate for players, advocate for their experience when they're using a game, when they're using a product, whatever, digital, even physical products, whatever it may be. I'm the one in the room pointing out, hey, it's cool that that works and is functional. However, remember, you are not the ones that are actually going to be using this thing. It's these people out here. Let's try to understand in what context it is that they're going to be using this, and making sure that we are providing the most seamless, the most efficient, the most usable experience while they're using it, in order to either complete tasks or to find the fun or through engagement, et cetera. That's the more like high level, you know, like, ooh, up here, you know, you understand a little bit about design. For people who don't know anything about design and don't really like, are not artists, are not visual communicators, et cetera, but kind of want to equate it to something that they might understand a little bit better. So when you build a building, or when you're like an actual like structure, like a building, you have multiple people that work on that building. You have contractors, you know, who actually like put up the wooden planks and the walls and everything. But before all that, you have the architects. So you have someone who comes up with the concept of this building, what the intention is behind the building, what is it going to be used? Is it a hospital? Is it a theater? Is it, you know, an opera kind of thing? Is it a business, et cetera? So they come up with the concept. And then I feel that as a UX designer, I look at that, I try to understand the concept and who is going to be using it, and I create the blueprints for it in kind of like in combination with the person who's thinking up, you know, the concept of the project and everything, which to me feels a little bit like the game designer. So for me, it's the person who's creating the blueprints, because, you know, we're measuring out like, well, you know, according to these standards, doors have to be made this certain way. Also have to take into account who's going to be using this space. So the doors may need to be bigger. How tall the ceilings are. Are we accounting for like also any sort of codes, like, you know, firefighter codes or whatever that we need to comply with, which over here in my case is a lot like, you know, the Apple standards and the Google standards and accessibility standards and all of that stuff. So same thing in digital products. We have to meet with these and FFC and all of that, and like, you know, COPPA and everything. We got to make sure that we're complying with those standards. Again, just accounting for how the space is being used based on who is going to, or what the purpose of the building is and who is using it. From there, it goes on to, you know, the contractors who start building the building. And we realize, hey, we don't actually have the right material to build this building. And then they come back to us and to me and be like, so it's wood instead of cement, or it's plywall instead of like this other material. So we have to make adjustments, you know, and work together with the contractors to ensure that this building can actually be built. And then a lot of folks, you know, ask me, well, what about UI or artists or that kind of stuff? Well, there's a whole discipline around that too, interior design. That's a whole expertise, you know, like how can you make this space livable and this space actually, again, usable for the people who are going to be in it.
I love that building analogy. That really simplifies things, because, you know, I was saying earlier, UX is kind of a foreign concept to a lot of people, but everyone's pretty much everyone's been in a building at some point, and oftentimes and you've been in a we have a shared language. We know what stairs are, we know what doors are, we know there should be an exit. We're aware of fire protocols and max capacity and things like we don't even think about it. It's just part of living in society. Right. I love that. I'm big on analogies. That really that's what a great way to understand understand what you do. I know a lot of UX people, partially by just being married to my wife. Do you have like I've noticed this pattern with UX experts is sometimes glomming UI and UX together. It's so common. You see it everywhere. Are you okay with it? Or do you like, does your eye twitch and you're like, I don't want to see that? Or like where do you land on UI UX?
So it is two different like areas of expertise, I would say. When you talk about UX, you are talking more about the general experience of it versus the what does it look like, you know, and does what it look like or, you know, match the theme of, you know, the, what it is that you're building. But the thing is they're not separate either. So like I have to work with UI designers, period. Like there's no way around it. And I lean into their expertise of visual communication, like really, really good visual communication that affects or helps direct a lot of the UI, the UX side of things, the flows, how things are animated, how we are providing feedback to users depending on what actions they're taking. So it's a marriage. But I strongly feel that it shouldn't necessarily be the same person. A lot of times when I see job postings, I see someone that, you know, we want you to do everything. We want you to do the research and the strategy and the UX and the UI and assets and implementation. And I'm just like, that is five people. That is a whole department. You know, and there are some folks out there that are full stack and, but you always see that they are way better at one thing versus another. And I feel it's almost like a disservice to that person to require so much out of them that you won't even get like the true quality out of it. Yeah, for me, if you can hire a UI and UX person separately, you're on the right track and have them work very, very closely together. But saying, you know, one person does it all, it happens. I've been in that position many times. But it just means there's less room for us to think about what it is that we're building. And more just like, hey, make this pretty and do the mocks and just kind of like a lot of throwing over the wall. Because there's no time. There's no time for more.
Yeah. I love also the marriage analogy you used where like, you know, the UX guides, the UI, like they kind of have to hold hands and it's a partnership. Mm-hmm. They kind of depend on each other. Right.
Yeah.
I think another thing to help us understand like what you do is I'm always interested in software. Maybe it's just because I'm a software nerd, but I think there's, you know, if you're writing code or you're working in the engine, a lot of times people know, like I think even some, you know, common gamers know about things like Unity and stuff like that, right? Photoshop, right? Like your average, especially like artist types, they know some of the tools that people use to make games. But what's some of the software that you use as a UX designer in your day-to-day? And like, are there any that you love or any that you dread? Like we all have those, right? Yeah. Like tools we look forward to using and ones we don't want to use.
So tools wise, software specifically, software wise, we've never really gone completely far away from Adobe. Like
it's understandable.
Illustrator, Adobe XD.
Oh, XD.
We still use it quite often. Nowadays, Figma is like a lot of folks are using that. We use it. I like Figma a lot. Their prototyping capabilities are pretty solid. However, depending on what on the type of project that you're working on, if something that needs a little more animation, I feel, or capabilities towards really customizing what how you can animate certain things. I really liked using Proto.io on that side of things. Their animation capabilities let me do almost anything I wanted. Granted, I had to create a lot of assets myself in order to, so compared to like something like Figma, where you can create pretty much any asset within Figma itself. You know, if there's a specific icon or anything like that, I could do it there. Proto.io, you can, but it's like kind of clunky. But if you already have something created, you just need it to animate a specific way within your prototype, then I feel Proto.io can do that a lot better than some of the other things I've seen out there.
Interesting. Is it like a keyframe based animation, like tweening type tool?
Yeah,
is that what it's doing to get that done?
Yeah, it feels more like that. Or it really, and it also handles like state changes really well.
Oh.
So you can set up state changes to function the way animation would, like a keyframes and that kind of stuff would. I felt more freedom with it on that side of things. But with everything else, like layout, setting up styles, all of that stuff, like Figma is really solid, especially if you really want to set up like a good design system and a style guide. Figma is great. Like their components, their ability to switch between different variables within the components and that kind of stuff. It's pretty solid. I know a lot of folks. Oh, sorry.
Oh, that's all right. I'll have to look into Proto.io. I hadn't heard of that one. The way you're describing it, it kind of makes me think of another Adobe product from back in the day, that their Flash with ActionScript. I still kind of like, maybe I just don't have enough software awareness these days, but I feel like there's a hole still where like Flash was such a special thing for a long time, where it kind of bridged the gap between, yeah, you could make it to, or you could use it to make a whole game, but it was also easy enough to use to where you didn't have to spend weeks or months learning it. You could put together some animations pretty quickly, and ActionScript was pretty good, easy to learn language. Like it was a nice tool that kind of everyone on the team could at least use in some capacity or be familiar with.
Yeah, it still exists. It's just not called Flash anymore.
Really? Oh, what is it now?
Animate.
Oh, just Adobe Animate?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
It's same thing. I think just, you know, with some updates. Yeah, just rebranded. Oh. And then a lot of folks in UX use After Effects.
Oh,
to
yeah.
Do like, especially if it's like really complex animations or behaviors that they feel like a prototype just, you know, that's created in Figma just won't be able to accomplish. Mm-hmm. They'll go ahead and do it in After Effects, no problem.
Yeah, I do just enough editing, like for this video that we're making, this podcast, where I use Final Cut Pro, and like I know how to do just enough. But like, you know, people who are actually on YouTube making videos and stuff, I always see impressive animations and things flying around the screen and really tight editing. It's almost always After Effects. Like when I look into it, it seems to be the de facto, like, make things squishy and juicy, things flying around the screen. Oh, I love that.
And side note, with Figma, one of the things that I really like about it is that there's community made plugins and community made libraries. So instead of you having to look up, you know, the same icon over and over and over on Google or something like that, or creating it over and over, you just pull it from an existing library.
Yeah.
You know, and that shareability, that almost kind of like crowdsource kind of feel to it. Like I feel like they're doing something right there.
That's great. Yeah. I've found it so important to, like, you know, we spend so many hours and hours in these tools, like just like, you know, you'll be like all day, I'm just using Figma today. I've got all this work to do. And it's like, it's so important that you like that tool, or else you just feel like you're using the worst hammer in the world. It's like giving you splinters and you keep hitting your fingers and you're like, I hate this.
Yeah. Yeah.
So which parts of your job do you look forward to the most? And are there any where you try to minimize it because you don't like it as much? Like, have you thought about those parts of your job?
So parts that I like most, in my case, I'm an incredibly collaborative UX designer, like, period.
Perfect.
I believe in the value of leaning into expertise that is not my own and emphasizing and really like, oh, the shining light, this is our engineer, you know?
Love that.
But I also expect the same from, you know, my team. So I love doing design sessions and workshops because we are all in the same room, different disciplines, talking about this problem we're trying to tackle together or this pain point we're trying to tackle together. So it's not just about me coming up with the perfect design, because that doesn't really exist. it is about trying to identify the most successful solution that we can provide, given what we can design or how we hope to design this, the limitations in our tech, the limitations in the hardware, and any stakeholder requirements, et cetera. And we all come together to kind of like align on that problem. And we come out of those sessions with a way forward together rather than, you know, like playing this game of telephone through Slack and like, well, so-and-so said this, or like through documentation that like someone reads a week later. It's like, no, like, let's just bang this out for, I mean, yes, it's like 3 hours long, 4 hours long, but let's just like take time. If this is really important, you know, and I feel it is, take time to sit down, think through this problem rather than just assuming we know what the solution is. I love doing that. It is so fun. and it really puts what UX is and does into my team's hands. And it's not always like, well, you know, Coralie's our UX designer. We'll, you know, anything UX related goes to her. And it's like, no, UX is like a process, a mindset. It is from the moment the user hears about, you know, whatever it is that you're building to the moment they use it and decide not to use it anymore. And, you know, it impacts all of it. So the entire team should adopt this mindset, not just Coralie, you do it. And right. That's it. If you really want the product to be successful. And I just, again, it's very fun for me. And it's also kind of like that teaching aspect. Like I scratch that itch. Things that I won't say like hate, but just kind of like, it's very tedious. It's very tedious. I'm in meetings a lot.
Yep. That's a common complaint across all disciplines, right?
Yeah. I'm in meetings a lot. And sometimes like as an individual contributor, you just kind of like want to do the work, but you also understand why you're meeting. But there are days where I'm just like in 8 hours meetings and, you know, that I know I'm not going to get any work done there. Not something that I hate, but something I didn't expect.
I love it.
I do a lot of writing.
Oh,
like I write specs. I write PRDs. I write a lot of documentation. I'm in Excel quite often as well. I did not expect that as a UX designer. I thought it was just all going to be like, you know, push this box to the right spot, you know, and layout stuff. And, but no, I do like a lot of written explanations of behaviors and use cases and edge cases and all of it. Let me think what else. And then the tedious part, sometimes you go down rabbit holes or you go like, you know, you tunnel vision on text and is this the right font? Let me move this up just a little bit. Let me move this down just a little bit. Oh no, the negative space is just not working for me. I have to like move this like just a little bit, maybe make this bigger. And then you see like my entire file has like 20 different variations of like the same panel. And I just don't know which one to go with. So, you know, when that happens, I just reach out to somebody else. I'm like, hey, I'm too close to the canvas right now. I need your input because this is driving me crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm spending too much time on it.
I love your collaborative nature. Andrea is always saying a part of her job is she's kind of like at the center of this like swirl of other teams where, you know, the programmers and the designers, like a lot of times they're not great at communicating, but it all comes down to the UX. Yeah. And so she'll have to be the one who facilitates that communication. Yeah.
Same. That's been my experience as well. Like, and it's really interesting because when you think about UX and you think about when you're playing a game, you don't think, oh, this has really great UX. It's not like, it's not like, you know, I mean, you see the menus and that kind of stuff and you're like, oh yeah, the UI, if you know what that is, but really like the heroes of, you know, a game is the art, it's the game design, the mechanics, like all these like very visual things that you forget that there are also experienced designers like on these teams. So we're kind of like these unsung heroes because we're able to make sure that everyone is aligned, you know, engineering is aligned and game designers and everyone is talking to each other because it impacts the experience so heavily.
Right.
And then that's where like that misunderstanding of like what UX is goes back to like, well, it's UI UX because UI is visual. I can touch it. I can feel it. I can see it. Versus UX is kind of like, oh.
Right. Yeah. It's like being in water. You're like the water's warm, but you're not thinking about that because you're doing something else. But like the atmosphere is excellent. Yeah, that's a great point. And it's like hard to convey in a screenshot. You know, you can see the UI, but you, like that UI might be awful to use once you start trying to actually use it. But the screenshot sure is pretty, right?
And the other thing is, oh, I'm so sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead.
My last point, I guess, is a lot of times when folks ask me like, well, what did you do? I'm like, well, I did this, but please understand that it was a collaborative, you know, approach or a collaborative design thing. So there's pieces of UI, our UI designer and things that they came forward with. And there's a little bit of like what I did and, you know, the game designer, like it's not just mine. I can't point at one screen and be like, yeah, I did all of that. No, like it would be a disservice to like the rest of my team. Because you know, the input is so valuable from them, from their expertise. And that's why like a lot of times in my portfolios and just explaining to folks like what I do and actually being able to show them an example of what I do. It's like, yeah, that's kind of hard to really say like specifically this.
Yeah. What advice would you give for folks who are interested in doing what you do? What's a good like starting point or is a degree required these days or is it highly recommended or what level or like should you be more networking or more applying or how did you get your entry, you know?
So for me, I do have a master's in video game development with a focus on UI UX because I come from a graphic design background and I do have a bachelor's in graphic design.
Wow.
So in my case, like I do have like that more formal, like you don't really meet a lot of UX designers that actually have a master's degree. A lot of folks go to boot camps, which I have my feelings about boot camps. More so, it feels very templatized, their approach. And I think it's missing a lot of like very key ingredients into like why we do UX. It just kind of like leans into the visual side of things and not the strategy side or not as much. So if you do go to a bootcamp, keep that in mind and try to supplement your learnings with other types of resources. Or find a mentor, because if you just lean into the boot camp, you're not going to feel like you're getting your money's worth, especially since a lot of them are really expensive.
Interesting. Yeah, I've heard that maybe not recommended, like, you know, unfair to have a big umbrella, you know, probably, but it sounds like in general, maybe not the path to go.
No,
I see.
I know a lot of game designers that have become UX designers. They transition a lot of engineers as well. Because they understand like the functional side of things. Like the person I'm working with right now, She's an engineer. She came from an engineering background. She has her degree in engineering, but she just found that she has a lot more fun, you know, doing UX, and she has a knack for it. So I'm mentoring her up, and she's been doing like great work as a UX designer. I also previously worked with another game designer that wanted to become UX. I've met producers that became UX designers because in their projects, they ended up finding themselves kind of like writing a lot of specs themselves for the rest of the team. And because producers are already kind of like the glue between teams, they already understand like all the different, like what all the different departments are working on. So right. they fell into it without realizing it. I don't think there's one way to be a UX designer, to be honest. A lot of folks come from other disciplines, not other disciplines, other industries. So, you know, apps, web, health, you know, they maybe were working on some sort of like health tech app or something. And they just didn't think about games. And then they're like, oh, wait, this is like actually way more fun. Let me do this instead.
Oh, that's always the path into games. It's like a black hole. The gravity sucks people in because it's like Andrea had worked for a consulting company, and they would were working on like dentistry stuff, which is, you know, some people really love dentistry, but like I think your average person probably has like a negative connotation to it because you just picture the pain and the cleanse, like, oh, I don't want to go and all that. And then you compare that to like, hey, a new Disney game. Yes. And she's like, sign me up for that. speaking of which, I know people who are on the podcast and only listening won't be able to see it, but they can appreciate the words. Your wall behind you is covered with Disney. Are those all Disney pins?
All of them are Disney pins.
Wow.
Yes.
The majority, very impressive.
The great majority are authentic pins.
It's amazing.
Some of the Ahsoka pins are fan made, just because there aren't very many Ahsoka pins that are licensed. But yeah, and I have way more than this in
boxes in the attic or whatever.
In the bins, yeah.
In the bins.
And every week more arrive. But yeah, like I've been doing this since. Oh God, since like 2001.
So decades.
Yep.
Decades now.
And wow. I think the collection is very closely approaching like 2,500 individual pins.
Wow.
I have a lot.
Very impressed.
Some of them are very limited edition. So maybe I think the lowest edition size I might have, I don't think it's on here.
That's very cool.
Yeah, I think the lowest I might have is like LE 100. So like they only made 100 pins of it.
Oh wow. 100 in the whole world.
Yep.
Collector's item.
Yeah.
Disney is such a beast now. They own everything in the world. You had mentioned earlier a Marvel project, and you know, also you work with Pokemon Go. What has it been like with you? Because like a lot of people I talk to, you know, I work in indie games that no one in the world has heard of. And even a lot of people I talk to work on companies which are even medium or large-ish, but still, you know, they just do not have the mind share of something like Pokemon, like a worldwide phenomenon. Marvel, never been bigger. Like, what has it been like for you working with those big names?
I think on the Marvel side especially, like, it's been a pretty easy, like, Marvel... The team that we worked with was actually like, yeah, like we trust you, you know, like to us. So even on the art side, maybe they were like a little more like, okay, this character can't look that way, or this character can't have, you know, a specific item because, you know, there's guides around their characters and the narrative around their characters. So on that side, yes, they are very like, make sure you follow this or don't stray too far from it. But when it comes to game design, they're like, we have a bunch of games out there, but we trust you as the developer for this to ensure that like the game design that you're doing or the mechanics or the experience, et cetera, like fits with your brand and our brand, you know? So I never ran into issues or any sort of like, well, you can't do this. Never, never. That hasn't been my experience. One of the really, really awesome things that happened this past summer when we announced the game, we were at D23, and that's when it got like announced, and just seeing that like on the screen and just being like, oh my God. And then behind me, I heard people saying, wait, Niantic? They're making a Marvel game. Folks were really excited about it. And you know, that little like, oh my God, yes, I worked on this feeling.
That's great.
But there with it also comes like a lot of pressure, because again, it is like such a widely recognized brand. The users that like, you know, I think of are folks that really, really know their stuff around Marvel.
Right.
So they're expecting, you know, they have Mega very fans. High expectations.
You get the details wrong, they will know and they will mention
it. And they will point it out.
They cannot help but mention it. It's like part of their, they keep their nerd card if they mention it to you, right?
Exactly. Like it's with me and you know, like Maleficent. Maleficent is like my favorite character, like my favorite villain, and Alice in Wonderland. And if one of these pins looks just a little off, I notice it. And then I question even myself, like, do I really want that pin? Because your face is not the right color. It's not like the right perspective. It doesn't look like her. So it's kind of the same with this, you know,
right,
this game where you have to make sure like, okay, like, is this what they're expecting from
you do
a
that,
game
you,
like this?
Yeah, you do that yourself with your own things. And that way, you know that your players are doing that with your games. So if you get something wrong, they will,
They'll point it out.
I love that. That's such a different world than where I come from, because like I was just reading some advice about making trailers for indie games, and they're like, cut your name, cut your title, just go directly to gameplay, because no one's heard of you, no one knows what it is. You just need to excite them immediately with like action happening, versus some of the IPs you like work with, it's like you should
like
show
cinematics.
Marvel. Begin with Marvel and then go from there, right? Like the opposite of what I'm doing.
If it makes you any feel any better, kind of going back to like the guidelines, especially for mobile. So developing for mobile, very different from very different process wise from developing for console. Where console, or at least a lot of AAA games, they have like a more waterfall style of development. We are very agile. So we run through sprints, and usually our sprints are 2 weeks and we have to finish something in 2 weeks, you know, so it's very quick. But going back to my point, but mobile also has a lot of guidelines that we have to follow, especially if we want to put something on like the app store, like on, you know, for Apple. And they usually send us like this long list of like, well, if you want to put a game on our app store, these are the things you have to meet and make sure your experience includes or doesn't include. And one of them on there is you have to ensure that your player or the user or anyone can have a meaningful experience in your game without having to create an account.
Okay. That's an interesting requirement.
Yeah, and that's kind of weird, because usually we'll like within the first 30 seconds of like, you know, downloading this game, we want people to be able to create accounts because we want to do things.
Attention and whatnot, right?
Exactly. Yeah. We want to measure like how well the game is doing or how well certain features are doing. But the only way we can really do that is if folks create an account somehow or link the account to somewhere.
Yeah.
So we can't measure then those first 30 seconds or the Fatui, you know, the tutorials or anything like that, because this requirement is now telling us like, hey, so yeah, you need to let them download and immediately experience your game without setting any limits. And you're just like, oh my God, how do I do that?
Wow.
So in that sense, it's a little different. I don't know.
That's a big one. Yeah, that touches UX. That would touch how you architect the game. You would need to have some kind of guest, like not quite a user yet, but you have retained some information about them and transfer that to an account if they choose to create one. Like, changes everything, doesn't it?
And then if something happens that within those first 30 seconds, that user is like, nope, I don't like this, and just kind of like, you know, uninstalls the app or whatever, there's no way for us to know because we don't have the information saved with
right.
No account was created, no ID was created. So we can't measure like how well those first 30 seconds do.
Hmm. That's so fascinating because I never would have expected that coming from the brand side, but it's part of the experience. You wouldn't like, just talking it out. You wouldn't want people to experience like a paywall or a headache if they're dealing mm-hmm. with, you know, Spider-Man or something like those. Those are not feelings we want to associate with Spider-Man. Spider-Man's a friendly, accessible neighborhood Spider-Man.
And you want to be able to use Spider-Man.
Exactly. Yeah.
Or anything like that. And just in case, like this isn't, I guess, a point of clarification. All game and tech companies do this. This is not specific to any place that I've worked at.
Sure.
Like it's not, I'm not revealing any sort of like special secrets or anything like that at all.
My hands are clean.
Yes, please. there are whole departments dedicated to understanding how a game, a digital product is doing and trying to measure, you know, retention, how many people are staying, how many people are leaving, why did mm-hmm. they leave? Like all of those things. Because it helps us then improve the products and improve the games. Makes for generally better experiences. Like there are companies out there that are very data-driven approach to design. And as a UX designer, you take into account those data points as well. Like if they dropped off, where did they drop off? What was the pain point that they ran into that made them drop off? And you help the team identify that.
Right. Yeah, that could be critical information, right? Like no one's seeing the part of the game that you're working the most on because, you know, you didn't realize it, but there's a part in the flow where people are dropping off because of a reason that was unexpected or something, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I got one more question for you. I thought it might be fun to end on a fun one. So, how about some of your favorite games? If you want, you could like put yourself in the headspace of like, you know, it just snowed and you're in a cabin and you have electricity, but you can't go anywhere for 3 weeks and you've got, you know, your three staple games. This is kind of a pitch, but you know, you could do it however you want.
So I mean, favorite game ever. I've talked about this quite a lot and why.
Really?
And I think I even did like a whole breakdown and everything.
Oh, okay. But I'll link to that if that's online somewhere. Yeah. I'll put all this stuff in the show notes.
I'll find it. So
great.
I love Journey.
Oh, cool.
Like for me, experiential games, in the sense of like, there is no UI. There is the narrative is very loose and open to interpretation. It is just me and my feelings. I really like games like that. Sky, which is its successor, touches on a lot of those things. Obviously, there's a lot more UI and a lot more features and things you can do in the game, but the things that made Journey, you can definitely see it in Sky and it translates. And they went beyond that. You know, now you connect with others and there's different ways that you can connect with others. So I would definitely replay Journey if I was awesome. In that cabin. Sky. And then I also really like twitchy games or you know, beat 'em ups. I like button mashing. I no strategy here. no blocks or parries, only
just hit
only
the A button mash. Quickly.
Yes. Hit button, number go high. So Bayonetta.
Oh, cool.
I'm replaying the second one right now because I want to play the third. Mm-hmm. But you know, time adulting doesn't really allow me dedicated time for it.
Those games are always so long too. All AAA games, they're like 40 hours of gameplay and you're like, I just want to get it done.
But I love it though. Like I love the Bayonetta series. So definitely that, and Hades. I would definitely want to finish it because not
choice.
Replay it, but like finish it. And then games that are way more chill, but also strategy focus. So Wingspan. So Wingspan is a board game that they created a digital version for on Steam and Switch, I think. It is an engine. It's like an engine creator with a bird theme around it, a bird casing around it.
That's so interesting.
You're just, you know, you're given this random deck. You don't even deck build at all. You are given these random cards, and the cards themselves build upon each other to kind of like operate almost like if you love systems, you will love Wingspan.
I do love systems.
Yes. And then Magic the Gathering, because yes.
Oh, close to my heart.
Yeah.
I'm still in my closet back here. I've got a bunch of ancient Magic cards I will never get rid of.
Mine are all like right there.
You can like see them.
Yeah. But I've been playing Magic for almost as long as I've been collecting. The only thing is I kind of need to play with somebody because I like physical Magic.
I'm with you.
Yeah.
I never got any of the digital games. I need to be able to, plus like something about playing with friends versus any kind of online, like I feel like I'm wasting their time. When I play with friends, I play so slowly and casually. They'll put a card down, and these days I don't know any. Back in the day, I knew every card you put down. I knew the art. I could tell you the flavor text. I knew everything. These days it's impossible. It's too many. So every card that goes down, I'm like, I'm gonna take my time.
Let me read it real quick. What does this do? And how are you like combining it? I want to understand. Yeah. Like I play really casually as well.
You could use these together, huh? How many cards do you have in your hand? And then I'll start, you know, I change the subject or whatever, but like people would hate that online.
No. One of the companies I used to work at, we had a Friday, every single Friday, we would play Magic with a group. At the company, like we would drink beers, order some food, and just play Magic for like 3 hours straight into the evening. And I really miss that because we had like a really good mix of people. Like some folks were very, very new to Magic, so we were teaching them. Others have competed like and actually won competitions.
Tournaments and stuff.
Yeah. And they like rank their decks and like all this stuff. And we have to be like, you gotta bring it down a little bit. Like it's a little too intense and we're playing casual here. And then others that are really more about teaching or just super relaxed, like, hey, can I like redo this? Because I actually did it in the wrong. Yeah, go for it. Don't worry about it. Like, it's just good times, good vibes. That's it.
Totally get that. Yeah. I play pretty loose with my friends where we'll be like, just keep shuffling until your first hand you're happy with.
Exactly.
Like that's it, over the years it got more and more loose. It used to be pretty like, oh, well, you get one reshuffle. Now these days I'm like, if you don't like your first hand, you might have a miserable game. You might get no land. Like that just happens, right? So like if you like your first hand, I like my first hand, we're gonna have a great game.
Yeah.
Casual and friendly. Well, this has been great. This has been educational. We are learning about UX. And I will put a link to all of your great stuff in the show notes. Everybody can find that stuff. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening. To keep the conversation going, check out my recent appearances on the Single Player Podcast and the SML Podcast. Links in the show notes. Now it's time for you to go make the game.